Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, March 1st, 2026, is by Ursula Volz on the topic of teaching children thinking.
So, teaching children thinking. When I first proposed this as a topic for a Sunday service months ago, my intent was to give us all a respite from the frightening farce of national events. The last few days continue that. It's imperative that we all learn to think. Since then, through my own spiritual and intellectual experiences, I have naively begun to grasp that fear leads to suffering, leads to self-doubt, leads to anger, leads to hate, leads to violence, amplifying suffering for all. Fear-mongering is rampant in American popular culture. When conflicting accounts of events, both global and local, provoke each of us to question what we value, where we find joy, and where we find joy. I thought I could read this without worrying about what's happening in the world. I can't. In previous UU congregations, we opened the service with the words, "Let us open our hearts to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another." It is a stealth trinity among us non-Trinitarians. While spirituality mostly feeds my eyes and my heart, analytic thinking mostly feeds my search for truth. Recently, a sermon by Bruce Lee Clark and a presentation by Bruce Lehrman both spoke to the nature of truth. To find truth, you need to learn to think analytically. This, according to our founding fathers, was the bedrock of a democracy. As a computer science educator for 50 years, I have tackled the conundrum that the foundation of my discipline, which I love, is that truth is merely the opposite of falsehood. Full stop. The answer produced by the algorithm is correct or it is not. Same goes for the answer on a formal written exam. John Dewey wrote extensively about this about 80 years ago. He said, "Knowledge comes from experience beyond what you are told by the authorities. You have to have confidence in your ability to think for yourself." 60 years ago, Banish Hoffman, a physicist in the biography of Einstein, in a book called Tyranny of Testing, made a cogent and thoroughly logical argument that standardized machine-readable exams promoted superficial responses over deep understanding. 40 years ago, one of my mentors, Seymour Papert, in Mindstorms, promoted the idea that teaching the computer how to do something provided experience in thinking for yourself in ways not supported in American culture. His vision of little scientists programming computers remains elusive. Instead, as Kathy O'Neill, a professor at Barnard, eloquently explained a decade ago in Weapons of Math Destruction, computer algorithms and statistical methods discourage teaching thinking as teachers are forced to teach to the test. Around the same time, Diane Ravitch, I won't give her biography, I hope you know her, in Reign of Error presented a picture of how public education was at risk because of an emphasis on a narrow definition of assessment that prohibits, yes, she claims, prohibits students from engaging in experiences that promote thinking. The right answer is everything. And who determines the right answer holds the power to influence how people think. What all these careful thinkers have in common is a plea for making education about the joy a student has when they are engaged in using their minds to search for truth and to create beauty themselves and help each other discover the wonder of the universe. Meeting the external expectations of a ridiculously judgmental consumerist culture that sorts them into categories doesn't do it. Igniting their curiosity does. Here's a personal story. 2 decades ago, I was a room parent in my daughter's New Jersey second grade classroom at a time when I was also part of an international initiative to broaden participation in computing. As I handed out cupcakes, I asked each of the 20 students, "Do you like math?" To a number, they answered either apologetically, "I'm not good at math," or proudly, "I'm good at math." Second grade, they didn't even hear my question. So let's cycle back to fear and where it leads. You can't think straight if you are afraid. To think straight, you have to have confidence in yourself, that you know how to think for yourself, and know how to communicate your thinking to others, and be able to understand what they have to teach you. You have to be competent in a vast array of skills necessary to learn what is true, to see what is beautiful, and to trust in the power of love. In Mindstorms in 1980, Seymour wrote, "You can't think seriously about thinking without thinking about something." So for the remaining time, let's think seriously about teaching thinking in a few selected contexts. So, in early fall, Jerry O'Connor saw me back there sewing and has privileged me by inviting me to his very special class in the middle school in order to get acquainted to two wonderful young women. Jerry will speak to the need for civics education.
Civics education. When Ursula talked to me about coming here in my classroom, and Linda's come also, talked a lot about students that are in there and how they think, and we've had great conversations, how kids think, how they learn. So when she asked me, approached me about, I thought I was coming in with that segue to teach, talk about thinking, and then it kind of morphed into civics and ethics. So this past week, after 3 hours of diving in and trying to write something about civics and ethics, I said, hell no. But I think she'll be okay with what I got going. Because I always thought my passion is educating kids and getting them to think, and thinking out loud was important. So I felt that's the way I had to go. But it, for one thing about what I've researched as far as the internet and what's worth for information, these states, like 50% of our population can't even name the three branches of the government. And with the 50 that can, a lot of them couldn't tell you what the function of each one of those is. So it's a sad state of affairs. But I will say that in Congress sits right now a Civic Strengthens Democracy Act that was bipartisanship, but by all partisan means, just sitting in Congress. So whether it gets out there or not, civics isn't the top priority in our country, unfortunately. But teaching kids to learn and the joy of learning, that's my goal. So with that being said, as far as my civics presentation, I thunked it, I extrapolated and debunked it, then I junked it and thought to myself, thinking out loud, I'm Dr. Seussing it, because tomorrow is his 122nd birthday. I will make him proud, henceforth the poem, to think a thunk, to thunk a think. I think what I am what I think, but if I think too much, my brain gets in a bunch. Oh my God, I'm out to lunch. What am I doing? When I don't know what I'm doing, I think to myself while I'm stewing. Will I figure it out while the coffee's brewing? Do I think to myself? Do I think out loud? Will I get it or remain in a cloud? I went to my doctor about my condition. Please tell me, doc, I don't need a mortician. No, it's my position. You need a dose of metacognition. Metacognition is a fancy term. You start with a notion of what might work. You monitor the process without a smirk. You evaluate the outcome and hope you don't irk. But if you do, remember this. The process of thinking is cyclical in nature. So with that in mind, follow in kind. Revisit the mind map that you grew. Reset the process and start anew. Hopefully from there, you'll know what to do. If not, cycle it over through and through. I guarantee you one day it will come to you. Children are resilient, as you can tell, if we spend the time to teach them well. Inspire them to think instead of dwell. They'll heed the call and answer the bell. So I leave you with this, with thoughtful bliss. When you're on the brink, just stop and think.
Mark Simpson is going to be a bit more thoughtful.
Thank you, Ursula, and good morning, all. Although I am neither professional musician, nor music educator, nor parent, I know that teaching children to play music achieves far more than simply introducing them to a pleasurable hobby or even future vocation. Such joyous outcomes are real, but music gives much more. I suspect that the root of this may be our natural sympathy with how the core components of music exemplify and embody mathematics. Think rhythm, the tempo and length of notes, or pitch and harmony, an octave forms a frequency ratio of 1 to 2, for example, or the sequences, symmetries, and disruptions that create patterns of tension and release, compelling our attention as we listen to music, all rooted in meaningful numeric formulae. Because of the indissoluble link between music and mathematics, the ancient Greek philosopher Pythagoras, for whom number, ratio, and proportion were the first principles of all existence, thought music was our guide to the harmony of the spheres, a way to understand the universe. Thus, for him, music purified the soul and allowed synchronicity with the heavens. A little later, Plato prioritized music's role in fostering the good in a person, having Socrates say, I quote, "Rhythm and harmony permeate the inner part of the soul more than anything else, affecting it most strongly and bringing it grace." Being a religious skeptic, I'm not sure about the ancients' use of the word soul in this context, but if it means somehow how someone acts and thinks, then modern science gives strong support to their notions. For we now know, via brain imaging, that music activates a vast network of neural structures, stimulating not only hearing, but movement, vision, and emotion. Because music energizes so much of the brain, including the auditory cortex, motor cortex, cerebellum, prefrontal cortex, and hippocampus, it encourages the tapping of feet, the swaying of bodies, and the development of refined hand-to-eye coordination. Even more important, it fosters neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to recognize itself and form new neural connections. Music literally rewrites and rewires our brain, and in many ways strengthens it. Scientists have concluded that children trained in music are likely to have better reading skills, verbal memory, second language acquisition, and executive functions. Learning to play an instrument apparently improves academic performances and IQ scores in young adults. If playing music links a child to mathematics, Greek philosophy, and encourages cerebral neuroplasticity, it also teaches life lessons. Individuals learn the value of discipline and persistence. After all, practice makes perfect. In groups, making music epitomizes productive social interaction. Subsuming the self within an ensemble, a musician adjusts, responds to, or initiates conversations, whether echoing those of earlier times through the language of written music, which is itself a second language that they have learned, or improvising afresh by ear. Often, the most important part of an ensemble's communication is wordless, transcending the verbosity to which we humans are prone. And that, I believe, might be the greatest of music's gifts, the opportunity, the necessity even, to think without words. As an experienced professional once counseled someone just beginning her career, it's when the words come that you're finished. They destroy everything. Thank you.
Katie Montavon, who I met a few years back and witnessed her teaching undergraduates, has stepped in and is going to extemporaneously in less than 5 minutes.
And have been doing a lot of thinking about how we teach mathematical thinking and problem solving and how we get past the blocks that high school math often puts into place for our students. And in the quote earlier, I caught the undeterred by failure piece of Barbara Kingsolver's quote. And that That, I think, is what I try to do in our 2000-level courses. Other colleges, they have topics they try to cover. I try to teach students to push through failure and see it as part of the learning process and a step to figuring things out. And so when I'm teaching students at any level, but especially at the beginning levels, a lot of it is, here's a challenge. How can I get you excited about this challenge? And then to start to figure out, how do you make progress when you have no idea how to make progress? And that ability to problem solve and figure things out is so big. And if they can figure that out, then they can do all sorts of things. And that's often how we get new math majors at the college. The other thing that struck me from the earlier part of the service was this moving beyond what you're told by the authorities. And one of the things in my intro classes is that I do not tell answers. Students will come up to me and say, is this right? And I'm like, well, what do you think? How do you know? How confident are you? Have you checked with classmates? Do you have questions about your answer or how you got there? And they're really frustrated for the first 3 to 4 weeks until they figure out, I'm just not going to tell them the answer. and I explain that this is part of the teaching and part of the learning, is to figure out how you know how confident you are in what you are thinking. But it is a challenge. The other thing that came up in my mind as I was thinking about talking about learning is that last year in the spring, I did a tutorial with a few students creating an ephemeral math museum to take into the elementary school. And I had been dreaming about this ever since I went to the Museum of Mathematics in New York City, is that it is so cool to get to play with math and have like real math playable. But most students don't have access to the Museum of Mathematics in New York City. And so I was wondering if we could create something that could travel here. And so my students created, 4 different exhibits that we'd put on for a day in the library of Tate School. And when they were talking about kind of introducing students to what they'd be doing, these undergraduates said, we're going to do math that doesn't involve numbers today. And in the reviews afterwards, the students were like, I love doing math without numbers. But that kind of, how do you think through problems and get students excited and seeing that math is more than just addition, multiplication? There's so much more there. Those are my thoughts.
Judy, I think, is up next. She's going to speak to us about creativity.
To start off by saying welcome to the beginnings of springtime. This joyful season of creativity. I'm going to begin this morning's service with some thoughts on creativity. I'm a visual artist, good, not so good, and in my advancing age, struggling. Nonetheless, creating visual art involves curious eyes, willing hands and fingers, various art supplies, and an abiding appreciation of the visual splendor around us. Whether it be gatherings of colorfully attired friends and associates, eye-catching clusters of trees and floral growth, colors and attendant odors of various foods, the clever design and color arrangements that animals enjoy to help them navigate, communicate, protect themselves, and thrive. It's all art, and it's all functional to move us through life in a positive, appreciative, and sometimes even in a joyous manner.
Next, we have Joyce Fuller, who I think some of you don't know is both a teacher and a librarian and whenever we get together, she challenges my thinking. She will speak to thinking about how to answer challenging questions, or maybe not. Maybe she'll follow Jerry and talk about what she wants to talk about.
You said follow the email. That's where I went.
First of all, good morning. Many of you know I had experience for many years as a school and a town librarian. It was in an elementary school across the state, and it was a ton of fun. Anyway, I wrote this little talk over and over again, so my computer is just a security blanket. I'm just going to go with it and give you some thoughts and an example of why critical thinking is so important and how we can put it into more than a science experiment where kids are analyzing and going through the steps in a scientific way for some kind of result, you know, building a bridge that will hold the egg, building it out of paper or something like that. So I put together a unit for fourth graders about birds, and I'm going to obviously be leaving some spaces because there are all kinds of standards to meet in education and there's information that kids need to get out of the project and skills. But the premise is the fourth grade is doing a unit about birds. The shared information, the shared teaching goes between the fourth grade teacher and me. And we would meet early on and figure out what we wanted to do and what kinds of learning we wanted to happen. So we developed a program. This is all hypothetical. I'm not picking something that I actually did, but I wanted to give a clear example so that people can see where the critical thinking is coming in. Doing a program about birds with varying learning styles, be it writing, research, art, perhaps computer research before AI. Let's not get into AI. That's a whole nother territory. but a variety of things, and they're going to do this cooperatively with three students to a group. And they're going to do some of their work in the classroom, and they're going to do some of the work in the library. They need, at the end, they'll be, with teacher direction, they'll be have a bird that they're going to study, each group, an individual bird. And they're going to do all kinds of things. They're going to write a report. They're going to list facts. They're going to find out about food and habitat and particular things that help them live in that habitat through various research projects and activities between the teacher and the library. During that time, they're going to learn library skills. They're going to learn where to find the information and how to find it. They're going to learn what makes a good source. You know, is a cartoon thing with birds in it a good source, or is something by the Audubon Society a good source? And they're going to go through all of this. I mean, this is the fourth grade level, so we can't get too far along before the kids are ready. And then these groups are going to talk about the different, you know, find facts, find information, gradually develop, they're going to develop a poster with a diagram of the parts of the bird and some reasons why this particular bird lives in this habitat. They're going to build a diorama with the bird in the habitat. So they're going to get the art piece in there with all the information that they have. One child wants to learn the bird call and be able to do that, or they can pick a short bird video off the internet and do that. So they've got the sound in there. They're going to also find a poem or a short story about their bird or a bird in general that they can share. And all this is going to be put together, and at the end with a presentation, the group is going to get up and present. So they've got public speaking in there and organizing all their materials. At the close of all their research and all their discovery, they are going to be asked the question, if the bird's habitat changes due to a hurricane or other natural disaster where it's just wiped out, first of all, if that and assume that that bird individually, maybe not all of them, survives the initial onslaught of this horrendous weather or whatever is happening, will that bird be able to survive for a week, a month, a year, in your opinion? Because now they have all this knowledge, and I myself would not be looking for one exact answer, but I would be looking for them to think about, you know, how are they going to eat? Where are they going to sleep? Is their nest, if their nest is on the ground and the ground is all mud, what's going to happen to them? Where are they going to, I mean, looking for things like that. So that's the, even though critical thinking has been used through the whole thing, at the end of the whole unit, they have to take all their knowledge and put it into something that's their opinion, but they've gained this knowledge through a lot of different sources and developed an opinion about what's going to happen. And that's where I'll leave you, but that's the kind of thing that a school librarian does and would work with a teacher to do that, to encourage the critical thinking. Thank you.
And batting cleanup. We have Bruce, who needs no introduction, and who's the one who inspired me to change course a few weeks back when he presented up here.
What is a model? A model is an analog of reality developed to solve or understand a particular problem or phenomenon. We learn by expanding or elaborating our models of how the world works. A model is always a reduction, a simplification of the real world. A complete model of the real world would be useless. It would be just as unfathomable as nature itself. Many Eastern religions strive to remind us that our models are incomplete, that the act of imagining ourselves as outside of the model, dualism, keeps us from understanding our relationship to the oneness that leads us to wrong conclusions and decisions. Yet without models, the world in toto is incomprehensible. If you build a model airplane and it flies, you have successfully learned how to create the model, or at least to follow the instructions for creating the model. Your model of the craft work necessary to build model airplanes is expanded. Now, if it doesn't fly, and you keep asking why, your failure can lead you to expand your model to include all the principles of flight. It is the will to keep asking why that is the most important thing an educational system can develop. The public education system should strive to develop this will. How would you measure that will with a standardized test? How would finding the one correct answer, no matter how intricate, develop that will? Would getting the wrong answer, never to interact with the question again, help you develop that will? If you had been told that the inability to provide the right answer was a failure, would that help you develop the will to explore? Do our mental models contain more than just empirical facts and logical relationships? Do they contain emotions, ethics, inviolable laws, or limits? As a new pilot trainee, I faced the most common limitation of new students: manifestation of apprehension, with its requisite military acronym, MOA. My apprehension wasn't of hitting the ground too hard. My apprehension was of failing, not being good enough. And I only began to succeed when I took hold of the belief that I was good enough. I was smart enough, I was disciplined enough, I was coordinated enough to succeed in contradiction to the available facts. And I was assigned to an instructor who shared that belief. Expanding our models requires skepticism concerning assumptions and the limits of logic. Rationality isn't always rational, as any behavioral economist can tell you. You may have heard of the lawyer's definition of truth. The truth is the story that is supported by the facts. And if the facts support conflicting stories, then the jurors need more facts, more understanding to find a better truth. Children, all learners, need to develop the persistence and curiosity, the will to seek the better understanding, the better truth.
You who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the ones they pick, the one you'll know by. And don't you ever ask them why, if they told you, you would cry. So just look at them inside and know they love you, and you are the tender. Can know the fears your elders grew by, and so please help them with their youth. They seek the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picks, the one you'll know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you, you would cry. So just look at them inside. Told you you would cry, so just look at them inside.